Welcome to BioIT World's Trends from the Trenches podcast, your insider's look at the science, technology, and executive trends driving the life sciences. I'm Allison Proffitt, editor of BioIT World. This episode is hosted by Stan Gloss, founder of BioTeam, a life sciences IT consulting company at the intersection of science, data, and technology. Joining Stan today is Jean Caron of Bayer. Together, they discuss the future of digital twins, generative AI, and innovation. Let's listen in.
Good evening, Jean. Thank you so much for, you know, sitting down with me tonight. I know it's late your time and having a chance. So I'd like to, you know, get this conversation going, but a lot of people might not know about you and your background. So maybe a quick introduction to you and the work that you do at Bayer would be great.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan, for this opportunity. It's always a pleasure to exchange with you. And I'm happy to explain a bit where I'm coming from. So currently, I'm heading digital and commercial innovation at Bayer, and in addition, being the CIO. So I'm covering a variety of topics that comes from evaluation of the commercial value of our pipeline, market access, pricing, sustainability, and also digital health and the digital transformation. After a while working on that and really trying to make things happen, I was asked to, in addition, take the role of the CIO for pharma because if you want digital to happen, you need to make sure that we are digitalized and that we do a proper job with our data and the whole architecture. So I do not have a classical background from CIO because I started as a veterinarian and I did some science and got a PhD in immunology. And at the end of my PhD, actually, I joined the pharma industry. But I joined the pharma industry at that magical moment of hope where the first genome was read, where we thought we had the possibilities, the keys to target anything because we had read one genome and that we were all seeing in the horizon personalized medicine, preventive medicine, the ability to decipher complex diseases. And I started to work on genetic, genomic, proteomic, metabolomic, complex imaging, and so on, working on those data. That's where actually I got really attracted into this field of how do you integrate super high dimension data coming from these new technologies with the more classical kind of data, preclinical, clinical, and how can you make sense of that to support the classical path of research and development in pharma. But also how you start thinking about stratifying patients, considering subgroups of patients, considering that maybe what we see with the clinical data is the tip of the iceberg and we may want to scratch the surface and go further down into the mechanism to really have a better way of addressing the disease. So I went on from that, got the virus of data, so to say, and what it means. It means also organizing them, having the infra, having the solutions, the software. And I spent a lot of time on that, working on thinking about diagnostic, working on different R&D projects. And progressively, I went through, you know, leading projects to strategy, from strategy to commercial. From being in commercial and considering that there is a gigantic opportunity for us to integrate a bit of technology to help the patients and to help the patients being taken care of for all those non-visible moments where they are not interacting with the healthcare system, which is the sense you can also put behind digital health. Mm-hmm. And there I am.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I think about myself as an asthmatic and having a history of asthma my whole life. And I think about the times, the amount of information that I would generate if I was doing it digitally versus the few times a year I have an interaction with my clinicians. And the story is so incomplete towards looking at optimization of my care, that being able to actually find ways to digitize that experience from the time I take a medication to seeing how that medication works in all 24/7, and, you know, really journaling that out, that would be a much more rich data set for a clinician, for me, to take care of my health. So it's great.
I completely agree with you. Let's take a moment to consider what you said. Basically, what we are asking physicians to do is to elaborate a complete picture by using one information set captured at a special moment, which is the interaction with them, with also, you know, mixed with objective data and non-objective data. You're trying to get an image about a complex process by keeping one pixel out of 10,000. I don't think it's a very fair ask to have as the clinicians to really find answers to everything by hiding so many aspects. And also by not digging further into the mechanistic aspects. If we consider the evolution over the last 25 years, I would say a bit more, with in biology the rise of molecular signaling understanding, the addition of a lot of knowledge of what's happening inside a cell and how it works, for the entire body around, we got a lot of progresses. One area is spearheading the whole thing. It's oncology, obviously, because in oncology, cancers have been now characterized in so many subtypes. And we are at the point in time now where we even had the first approval for a drug to treat a certain mechanism, regardless where the tumor sits. Mm-hmm. It's, by the way, something that got done by Bayer, you know, Vitrakvi. It was the first so-called basket approval. It's based on the mechanism. It's based on the understanding of data and characterization of a tumorigenic mechanism that can be blocked with an intervention.
Wow.
That kind of redefinition, this very granular redefinition of disease, has not happened yet fully or not at all in many other disease areas. Mm-hmm. And then we come back to the power of data. We come back to the fact that there is an interest to better understand, better stratify, and try to have tools to scratch the surface of the classical, canonical clinical description. Mm-hmm. And if we go into that direction, it also means we need to have potentially a different approach. Okay. I'm going to date myself, but I'm part of the generation in the pharma industry where the motto was from bench to bedside, which was about, you know, being faster in translating preclinical research into the clinic and make it happen faster for the patients. It's extremely interesting. That helped a lot. It helped a lot in many diseases to go faster, to find more agile ways to get the drug to market. But at one point, you still realize that we've got a very heterogeneous response to drugs. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work the same. And yes, there is the genetic makeup of each and every patient, of course. There are also all the factors in around the patient, the history, the environment, the food, and so on. But it doesn't explain everything. It's probably because there may be some little things we do not capture yet on mm-hmm. describing those diseases. So I would say now that it may be the time to think about another approach. Another approach, which is to rethink and accept a first statement. The first statement is our models, and they are surrogates. And we know that they are imperfect, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
That explains our problems of translatability. We also can consider that we are at a point in time where technology has been developing enough to give us many other ways of describing a patient and a clinical reality.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads to the following. If you continue the reasoning, say, okay, now what if I was refocusing not on running a process from literature to model to preclinical to clinical, but focus on the problem to be solved. Hmm. And the problem to be solved happens to be in the patient, in the clinic. And I would say now maybe it's the time where we reconsider that the real trail is from bed to bench and back.
I am so glad you said that, because that when you described the drug development process going from the bench to the patient, we've been pushed on drugs our whole lives. But you know, if we had really good data sets like I described about my asthma, wouldn't that inform scientists who are developing drugs? If you could have information about my responses and when I have, and all of these other beautiful pieces of information that could go back and again, moving it back. So be able to create a model of me. So when we go to that level of model of me, then it gets me right down to a question I have to ask you. Do you think in the somewhere near future, we will end up with digital twins of ourselves, that eventually we'll collect enough information about what's going on in my body that I can have a digital twin, so that when you prescribe a potential treatment for me, we can test it out on my digital twin first? Because, you know, I know right now there are buildings that are being built all over the world that have digital twins of building and can see how everything works in a building and is working in every system and every function. Could we be moving in that direction, or do you see that in our future?
Okay. I think it's an interesting question, the digital twin. And I'm going to throw the question back at you.
Okay, good.
Why do you need? Do you really need a digital twin to model everything? Or do you need something to help to live better with your asthma?
Good
question. Do you want to wait 10 years until you got a perfect model, or imperfect, because no model will ever be perfect? or you need to have something faster that really helps you concretely on the problem you've got to solve. What would you be interested in a complete digital twin if your concern is to have a better life with your condition?
Right.
And I think if I'm telling you, it's very interesting because it's also a discussion I'm having with another company in which Fire invested. It's called Huma. They've been working with AstraZeneca also, not just with Fire, on HASPEMOL. And what they are doing is really to help the patients and to help the caregivers and the care providers, the care centers. And think about something that integrates your treatment, provides you guidance and nudges, integrates the weather, pollen forecast, exposure to potential triggers, mm-hmm. and monitors your reaction, can give a signal when it may be time to actually escalate your treatment, may give you a signal that you better get your nailer with you because, hey, you know what, pollen season is back. Something that really addresses your concern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The digital twin is an extremely interesting concept for patients. Mm-hmm. The problematic is that for the moment, in what I think, you know, being very pragmatic, don't remember, I'm a veterinarian to start with, I'm extremely pragmatic. To be very pragmatic, I would prefer to now to focus on the problem to be solved mm-hmm. now than trying to reach that perfection. And what I'm telling you that is, for the last 20 years, I've entertained discussions with people who are extremely advanced in modeling and simulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the conclusion that those people are extremely refined in being able to model planes, boats, whatever, industrial processes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still confronted with one thing, which is to model, you need data.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We do have a lot of data. But do we really have all the data we need to properly model the functioning of a complex organism? We may have some imperfect model. But I mean, there are a lot of data we do not have in terms of understanding how all the protein expressed are interacting, understanding how this interacts with other mediators like lipids. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you look at, you know, the amount of knowledge and literature accumulated, we have a very strong focus on proteins. We have way less of a focus on other categories of molecules, but still are extremely important. Everything derived from lipids, for example. You know, today, I don't know if anybody can tell you that if they can model what is exactly the effect on activity on the sugar motifs you find on proteins.
Mm-hmm.
It's, by the way, a very relevant question, because if you are able to actually predict exactly what a change in sugar motifs on a monoclonal antibody is doing, you wouldn't have to face all those cumbersome things every time you change the production process of a therapeutic monoclonal antibody.
Mm-hmm.
For the moment, we don't. There are a lot of things where it's still very hard and very complex. So I think it's going to be probably iterative. But I mean, it doesn't mean we should not try to address specific discrete problem that can bring a benefit to both the healthcare system, but providing, you know, solutions to help a kind of a continuity of care, and can help also the patients have a better life.
Right.
Why should we wait for, I would say, the long distance vision if we can already put the technology in motion to support patients?
So I'm going to answer your question. You're right. I want my life right now optimized for the best lifestyle I can have with the medications that I'm taking to control my asthma. If you had an app that could tell me right now, we have problems in the United States with the smog coming down from wildfires in Canada. And it changes from day to day. And should I go out? Should I bring my inhaler? All of these things to guide optimal, lifestyle. So I'm hiring the healthcare system, honestly, to keep me at my optimal health. So do I need a digital twin for that today? No, but every little step that you innovate along the way that brings me closer to an optimal outcome in my life, I'm in. No question. I will participate with you and be a partner with you. And if you can show me how collecting my data helps me help you, help me, that circle of this circle of life, so to speak, that would be terrific. So I guess I want you, you talked about your role involved with innovation. So tell me a little bit about what innovation means to you and Bayer in this circle of life that you've described.
I like to have kind of an open definition of innovation.
Good, tell me.
But coming back to, I would say something that needs to be in everybody's mind when you talk about innovation. And I'm going to go back to what are the conditions for something to be patentable? You know, something to be patentable, it's not good enough to be new. It has to be applicable and useful and non-obvious. But I will keep the term applicable. And innovation for me is something that makes our current situation go toward a point where it's a better situation and it's actually applicable and it's new. So in the whole process of innovation that we are trying to have all the time, there is the innovation per se where we find new mechanisms, new drugs, new things we can apply that end up being packaged and delivered to patients. But there is a lot we can do for ourselves as an industry all along our value chain to incorporate innovation, to make our value chain more productive and faster, and maybe giving ourselves more shots on goals. And I think it's also an important part. Now, what does it mean, innovation today? You can start looking at the glass half empty and say, okay, there are so many things that happened over the last decade in terms of finding new treatments, in terms of having a lot of new modalities. What is left? What is left for us now to find new that can really change and so on? I'm saying, okay, yeah, that's true. And especially when I look at the situation with my market access and pricing eyes, think, okay, what are we going to bring on top of the standard of care? Is that really a need for the society and for the patients?
Right.
But at the same time, if I take all the big chronic diseases, what do we do with those? With cardiovascular, with metabolic diseases like type 2 diabetes and so on. We manage them. We manage chronic diseases. We manage symptoms of neurological diseases, of metabolic disease. We manage them. We don't reverse. We don't cure them.
Right.
There's
exactly.
Still space for bold innovation. In addition, if I'm looking at what's happening after you release your drug and you hope it's going to work, and it's going to work maybe close to what you were able to demonstrate in a nice clinical setting. And I remember having that discussion about diabetes and people telling me, well, there is not much room for innovation now in diabetes. Glucose control, you look at the clinical results, it's pretty good, it's hard to do better. And then you look outside, only 50% of the patients do achieve a proper control. And then comes the question, what if, in that case, the innovation is not going to be the treatments, but the way we use them and the way we adapt them to the life of patients. What if it's maybe the proposal we have on how to do things that doesn't fit with the life of patients and with the very, I would say, difficult endeavor that it is to deal with something in a chronic state.
Right.
Because never forget, there is also a very important assumption, which is that the first thing a patient wants to have is stop being a patient and get that out of his life.
Exactly. So going back to the topic of innovation, John, Clay Christensen talked about three different types of innovation. It's not just one innovation. He talks about market creating innovation. You know, you now created a new category of drug, or you created an iPhone or something that grows exponentially because you satisfied an unfulfilled non-consumption issue in the marketplace. Something wasn't being consumed. The second type of innovation is sustaining innovation. And then the third type of innovation is efficiency innovation. So the question is which type of innovation are we working on? And for me, when I think of innovation, it could be blockbuster type, like market creating, but most of the innovation that we talk about is sustaining or efficiency. And in those models of innovation, what we're really looking for is what you said, we're making progress. And it's going to be incremental. It's not an exponential growth like a market creating innovation that now all of a sudden the floodgates are open and we're kind of seeing that, feeling that with actually generative AI. That is not coming in as a, that's not incremental. That feels pretty exponential. So anyway, I just wanted to, you know, say that I agree with you.
Several things. The market innovation. Look at what's happening now with obesity. I've heard many years again and again, obesity is not a disease. It's a lifestyle issue. Obesity, the payers will never pay for it. No, there is no need for a drug for that. Just put people on diet, it's okay. And then after, you know, checking the reality of what's happening in the different populations, people started to realize it's a condition. It's a chronic condition. Even if you starve people, usually they come back to their original weight if you do not do something in addition. It's the root cause of many other problems that are becoming an unsustainable burden for all the healthcare system.
Exactly.
And then something which was considered not to be a market is becoming a market, and is becoming a market to fulfill an existing need that was not supposed to be a need based on the wrong interpretation of what we were looking at. So there are still some things that are happening in terms of market creation. We'll see how the Alzheimer's market is evolving later on. But now you are touching also the very important thing about generative AI.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah, tell me about that.
And what it does in terms of efficiency innovation. So let's take a step back. Why is it so important now, and why is it so getting so much visibility? First of all, AI did not start with OpenAI and ChatGPT.
No.
AI was starting, large language models started way before. What has changed? It's the accessibility that something like ChatGPT brings. It's a very important concept, the accessibility. But more fundamentally, what generative AI does, it's helping us, poor humans, to deal with an incredible amount of information being available today.
Mm-hmm.
It's aggregating, modeling, and associating all that body of information that none of us as human beings will ever have the time to read in a lifetime or to acquire in our lifetime. Because by the way, by the time you're done learning a chapter, you've got 1 million other chapters being written somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So it's really having that function of coping with a beyond human volume of information and being able to make sense out of it, answer questions, create synthesis, create new content or new assembly of content. Once you understand that, and once you're fine with that, but also know the potential caveats, the hallucinations, the fact that it can be extremely biased, mm-hmm. the fact that, by the way, it's working with data produced by human, by mankind, and that the body of evidence used to feed those models is, it's us. It's just us with our beauty and weaknesses, I would say. Now, the models have gotten smarter to avoid a certain number of traps, but it's what it is. It's helping you aggregating an Himalaya of information and make sense out of it and make it usable, actionable, and productive.
Mm-hmm.
Once I've said that, you can perfectly understand that it can be applied to R&D. How do you want to synthesize body of evidence? How do you synthesize vast amounts of information? How you also let the model work with its algorithmic principles to maybe help you have a completely different way of analyzing things than what you have in mind with your program frame.
Right.
It can help you discover patterns you had not discovered. It can help you assemble really, superhuman amount of information into something that can make sense and can become actionable. Interestingly, in terms of efficiency, I think we should not forget the very basic low-hanging fruits. A bit like the discussions we're having between the digital twin and the applicable now.
Right.
We have a lot of activities in our value chain that are very, very amenable to be simplified and accelerated by generative AI.
Mm.
We have information out of which we create new content in different formats for marketing, for medical, for answering questions of HCPs. We use a body, an elaborate and dense body of information to have something translated into something more approachable with different level of communications. And if I start to take the very basic example of marketing, we do create a lot of content globally that has been what we call transcreated to be adapted to different geographies, translated, in which we had visuals that needs to be incorporated, and so on. When I'm telling you that, I'm talking about activities that take a lot of time because we outsource in the pharma industry a lot to create the content, to test the content, to transcreate, to translate, to have the visuals. All this you can actually do from your desktop with a proper interface without contracting 3-4 different agencies. You can translate it.
Right.
You can adapt the visual. You can test faster. You can model things faster. Everything we do in standard protocolization, protocols, reports, all that, super amenable to generative AI. Super amenable also to put a lot of evidence to write something in a given format.
Right.
There are gigantic possibilities for us to gain impact. Think about your quality reports. If you just have the right information, instead of having people painfully writing quality reports, there you've got a format, you've got information, you can get an agent actually automatically doing that and updating that automatically.
Mm-hmm.
You can save a lot of repetitive tasks with low value add and give back time to your employees to focus on understanding the problems, shaping the questions, spending more time into looking externally and different aspects, being more creative, saving a lot of outsourcing costs. You can do all of that.
Right.
It's not that we want to replace employees with AI. It's just that we want to upskill and upgrade the quality and content of that job.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are making the repetitive aspects and the low cumbersome things by leveraging the technology. Inside, we actually have developed our own instance of generative AI with a chat function. And we are doing testing and validation of all what we were thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
We have been starting to generate our first ads that took us 3 days, including validation and stamps over, instead of 3 weeks.
Wow, that's amazing.
We are starting to have isolated cases, and it's going to help us to understand where we can really capture value in the short, mid, and long term, and how we are going to put that in the hands of the people doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because we will get the real benefit of this innovation the day we are able to democratize it, to help the people working all across the value chain in different positions where it makes sense for them to use it, to have it in their hands, not being constrained to go for a specialist function and so on. What Gen AI, especially with a chat interaction, then this kind of interaction with the human being is bringing now, it's unleashing the power of the tech to make the jobs more productive. It's, you know, the PC revolution or the Apple revolution,
mm-hmm.
Of advanced data analytics.
Right.
It's, yeah. And
yeah.
I mean, you don't need to be doing advanced analytics because you have in your hands something that can talk your language,
mm-hmm.
but leverages this tremendous power of technology in the back,
right,
to give you way more impact.
Mm-hmm. So my last question for you, the OECD from the World Economic Forum is forecasting that generative AI will impact 1 billion jobs between now and 2027. So as you look at your workforce and you see the amount of change that is going to happen within all of that and the jobs and to be done and things that people need to do, are organizations like yours thinking about how are we going to move that workforce into the industry 4.0 realm so that they have the skills? It's like we're almost moving into a skills economy where it's not no longer as much about what degree you have. It's really what skill do you have? So how do you see that? And let's blend it on that one, because I'm curious to get your perspective on it.
I would agree, I tend to agree, to say that it will impact many jobs. But now we need to agree on the definition of impact. It's going to change the way we work. It's going to change the way we look at things and the way we practice our job. As getting access to the email changed the way we work.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any more internal postmen. We don't have any more internal post. I mean, unless you have a very, very special document. Yes, it impacted the job of people bringing the post to your office.
Right.
But on the other hand, it did not impact all the jobs. But what changed is that it was expected now that the people are able to use this technology. And it's the famous motto is that your job is not going to be replaced by generative AI, but you'll be replaced by somebody able to use generative AI.
Ah, interesting.
So that's why it's important. it's going to be, you need to be able to use those tools, even more so that thanks to everything that has been done and the last 10 years of progress on chats and interactions like that, you've got the possibility to have a low hurdle of accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
People will have to use it. And they'll probably use it after a while without even understanding that they are actually using generative AI.
Right.
Like a bit what you, when you put your computer on, you're not you're not especially thinking that you're operating and you have an operating system.
Right.
You don't think about iOS every time you look at your iPhone. So it's this part of it where it's in the background, it's advanced technologically, and it's enabling others' people job. But it means that in each and every job, we'll have to think how we get people to get access, how we get them familiar with that, how we also help them to think with the knowledge they have of their own task, the expertise they've got of the job to be done in their position.
Right.
We need to make sure that they do understand a bit what this is doing. So with this expertise, they can merge the problem to be solved and the technology available. And that's where productivity jump is going to happen.
Wow. Thank you, John. Thank you so much. This has been an absolute joy sitting down and talking to you and getting your insights on these topics. I just wanted to say I've been waiting for this interview for a while, and I'm so glad that we've had a chance to talk and, you know, get this information out to the public and the people who are listening to our podcasts. And I just can't thank you enough.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to discuss with you, Stan. And I'm looking forward to continuing our discussions.
Until next time. Yeah. Take care.
Thank you for listening to BioIT World's Trends from the Trenches podcast.